So I had been working on a talk and sort of not really coming together. Then I realized this is going to be Easter Sunday. I ought to say something about Easter Sunday. So I had an idea. So some thoughts about Easter. As we know, it's kind of an odd holiday because it was originally a pagan fertility rite and was incorporated into Christianity. So we have kind of an odd mix of crucifixes and bunnies. Now, I'm a little ambivalent about the metaphysics involved, but I really connect with the emotions of spring, the sense of renewal, redemption, celebration. I'm in favor of those things, and flowers. So I thought, maybe I could talk about joy. But it's actually kind of, I'm going to get there by kind of an indirect route. So last week we were at church and the minister talked about how everybody wants to be an Easter Christian and not a Good Friday Christian. So for those of you who don't know about the church and its history, traditionally, Good Friday is supposedly the anniversary of the crucifixion of Jesus, and Easter is the day when he arose from the dead and whatever went after that. So what she was saying was that without Good Friday, Easter is just bunnies and eggs. I mean, there is something, you know, celebratory about it, but it means a lot more. The joy of Easter is more meaningful if you have passed through the sorrow of Good Friday. So I had an aha moment. You know, otherwise, you know, Easter is just bunnies and eggs. So I had this aha moment that there's kind of a dukkha lesson here. So this is partly, at least, a talk about dukkha. So you're probably going, oh, I know all about dukkha. I'm sick of dukkha. I don't like dukkha. Well, nobody likes dukkha. And I think that, yeah, you've probably, a lot of this is going to be a review, but I'm a big fan of review. You know, Barbara and I teach this class called Back to Basics, and we chose that name very specifically, not just because we wanted to do an introductory course. Or Philip asked us to do an introductory course, but we also wanted to encourage people to use it as a way of reviewing stuff. And it's been great for us because we get to go back over stuff and realize we never know it as well as we think we do. So having the chance to go back over it again is just a really good way of renewing our practice. So review is good. So a little bit about dukkha. As most of you already know, there are a lot of translation issues. It's one of those words, it's in the Pali language. Pali is a dialect of Sanskrit. The teachings of the Buddha were first put in written form in the Pali language. He didn't speak Pali. He spoke a language called Magadha, which was also a dialect of Sanskrit. So translation was pretty straightforward. So dukkha is a notoriously difficult word to translate. We usually translate it as suffering, and that's kind of a tradition, but that's really a Victorian era translation, and we're kind of stuck with it. But and a lot of people have trouble relating to that. We were teaching a course once, and somebody said, well, you know, suffering doesn't really mean that much to me because I live a pretty good life. So what's the applicability for me? So I said, well, how about anxiety? Bingo! So a lot of people, you know, suffering is kind of gothic sounding, kind of over-dramatized. But everybody gets stress, unease, things just not being quite right, unsatisfactoriness of stuff. So Tanisaro Bhikkhu, one of our preeminent translators of Pali, likes to use stress instead of suffering. And I'll be reading a sutta that he's translated, so you'll get to see that in action. And I like that, but I still end up using suffering just because that's sort of our tradition. And suffering, you know, suffering can be extremely subtle, and that's where it's sometimes hardest to notice where it sort of gets in our way. I like to use the example of somebody sitting on a beach at sunset. It's balmy. It's beautiful. Got a cold pina colada, comfy chair. And you say, oh, I wish this could last forever. You see how you've already introduced this subtle friction, wishing it could last forever? Already you know it's going to end, and you want to hold on to it so badly. And then, of course, it gets worse. You start thinking, gee, I wish we'd done this years ago. Maybe next year I can come back and make it 2 weeks instead of 1 week. That'd be great. Now, you'd probably be bored out of your skull after 2 weeks. You'd be sick of sand. But nonetheless, you have this thought that you'd like to grab onto it. You'd like to rev it up rather than just enjoying your pina colada on the beach. I call this pina colada dukkha. So a little bit about dukkha. And it's nice to use the word dukkha just because it has such a broad range of meaning, all the way from terrible anguish all the way to the most subtle of not quite rightness. So I'm going to read from there are a number of different suttas that have the First Noble Truth in it. I'm going to read one from the Samyutta Nikaya, and it's translated by Tanisaro Bhikkhu. And I like reading suttas, so what's a Dharma talk without suttas? On one occasion, Venerable Sariputta was staying in Magadha in Nalaka village. Then Jambukadika, the wanderer, went to Venerable Sariputta and on arrival exchanged courteous greetings with him. After this exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to Venerable Sariputta, "Stress, stress, it is said, my friend, Sariputta. Which type of stress?" Sariputta answers, "There are these three forms of stressfulness, my friend." I'm sorry, I got the wrong one. I got them out of order here. So this is the one about this is from the sutta, Setting the Wheel of Dhamma in Motion. So it's about the Buddha has just met up with his five former associates who were ascetics. And he figures, these guys are probably going to get what I want to teach. And not many other people might, so I'm going to start with them. And so he sits down and gives a talk, and this is just an excerpt from it. "Now this, monks, is the noble truth of stress. Birth is stressful, aging is stressful, death is stressful, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are stressful." All right, those are pretty blatant things. "Association with the unbeloved is stressful. Separation from the loved is stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful." Now, I'm not going to go into the aggregates tonight. "Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of stress. This noble truth of stress is to be comprehended. This noble truth of stress has been comprehended." Philip discusses this quite a bit in his book, Dancing with Life. And if any of you haven't read it or don't have it, then you're wasting your time listening to me. Please buy a copy, go home and start reading it. It's really good. I'm not a big fan of Dharma books, but there is no flab in this book. It's a very compact read. So this is the noble truth of stress. He's sort of saying, you sort of get the idea. This noble truth of stress is to be comprehended. Is you have to go beyond having the idea and have it as a gut understanding, as something that you really know inside, that you've experienced. And this noble truth of stress has been comprehended, is regarded as the Buddha acknowledging that he knows. It's as Philip Moffat says, it's not just that you have this gut feeling of suffering. You know. It's like you've gained wisdom from your gut-level knowing of suffering. You're actually able to bring it back into your life and make something of it more than just, I know suffering. So we're all pretty familiar probably with the second arrow simile. And I'm actually going to read the sutta, and it's a long one. The second arrow simile says that suffering is a lot like, there are things in the world that are just going to happen to us whether we like it or not. You know, we're going to stub our toe, we're going to lose a loved one, we're going to get fired from a job. You know, bad things are going to happen. But what we often do is we get so torqued up about the bad thing happening that, you know, like my knee hurts. Oh my God, I'm getting older. It's much worse than it was last week. Oh, but it's not as bad as it was last year when I fell down. But, you know, sooner or later I'm going to have to get artificial knees. Sort of like the pain is minor compared to all of the add-on stuff that I have stacked up on it. So the simile is that the first arrow is the pain in the knee. The second arrow is all that other stuff. The first arrow is not optional. The second arrow is, because that's us doing the shooting. So I thought this is kind of an interesting sutta, and it brought up some other points about suffering, about dukkha. Monks, an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person, feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, feelings of neither pleasure nor pain. A well-instructed disciple of the noble ones also feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, feelings of neither pleasure nor pain. So what difference, what distinction, what distinguishing factor is there between the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones and the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person? By the way, this is relatively terse compared to other suttas. When touched with a feeling of pain, this is the Buddha speaking, when touched with a feeling of pain, the run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. So he feels two pains, physical and mental, just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow and right afterward were to shoot him with another one, so that he would feel the pains of two arrows. In the same way, when touched with a feeling of pain, the run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. So he feels two pains, physical and mental. Of course, this is aimed particularly at physical pain, but you can see how it's applicable to emotional pains as well. As he is touched by that painful feeling, he is resistant. Resistance to that painful feeling obsesses him. Touched by that painful feeling, he delights in sensual pleasure. Why is that? Because the run-of-the-mill person does not discern any escape from painful feeling other than sensual pleasure. As he is delighting in sensual pleasure, that feeling of pleasure obsesses him. He does not discern, as it actually is present, the origination, passing away, allure, drawback, or escape from that feeling. So not only do we get caught up in the suffering that we've induced, we quickly try to cover it up, you know, have a good stiff drink, or, you know, do something, you know, go for a nice walk in the woods. So we haven't really dealt with it, but we add all these obsessions on it as well. There's another interesting thing about this, but I'm going to come back to it later. Sensing a feeling of pleasure, he senses it as though joined with it. It's sort of like you get totally identified with having that cool thing. Like, I feel really crappy. I think I'd feel so much better if I went out and bought a new drum set. Yeah, there's really good drum set with a retro finish that I've been seeing in the store window. That'll make me feel great. So I really deserve that, you know. My old set, just I've never quite got the tuning right. So I'm joined with it. I'm stuck with it. It's like I've become a person. You know, people use the phrase taking birth. And this is sort of like I've taken birth in this person who deserves a drum set. So all this, just starting from, I don't know, having a bad knee or whatever mine started with. So sensing a feeling of pain, he senses it as though joined with it. Sensing a feeling of neither pleasure nor pain, he senses it as though joined with it. So he's not letting neutral feelings off the hook here. This is called a run-of-the-mill person joined with birth, aging, and death. That I took birth in wanting the drum set. I took birth in my cranky knee. joined with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, lamentations, pains, distresses, and despairs. He is joined, I tell you, with suffering and stress. Now, the well-instructed disciple, when touched with a feeling of pain, does not sorrow, grieve, or lament, does not beat his breast or become distraught. So he feels one pain, physical, but not mental, just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow and right afterward did not shoot him with another one. So that he would feel the pain of only one arrow. In the same way, when touched with a feeling of pain, the well-instructed disciple does not sorrow, grieve, or lament, does not beat his breast or become distraught. He feels one pain, physical, not mental. As he is touched by that painful feeling, he is not resistant. It's an interesting phrase, not resistant. It's not like he's ignoring it. It's not like he's willing it to go away. He's just allowing it to be. He's not resisting it. He's not fighting it. It's the fighting against the pain that starts that whole cycle of larding on a whole bunch of stuff on top of the unavoidable pain. So he's not resistant. No resistance to that painful feeling obsesses him. Touched by that painful feeling, he does not delight in sensual pleasure. Why is that? Because the well-instructed disciple discerns an escape from painful feeling other than sensual pleasure. As he is not delighting in sensual pleasure, that feeling of pleasure does not obsess him. He discerns, as it actually is present, the origination, passing away, allure, drawback, and escape from that feeling. I think that phrase, as it actually is present, is important. Because he's actually perceiving the feeling as it is. And when you perceive a feeling as it is, you might notice that it has a cause, it tends to arise, and it passes away. Everything arises and passes away, and sometimes that works in our favor. With pain, it does. So he also discerns the allure, drawback, and escape from that feeling. All the stuff that we don't like, all the stuff that we do like, all the stuff that sucks us in. Sensing a feeling of pleasure, he senses it disjoined from him, from it. Sensing a feeling of pain, he senses it disjoined from it. Sensing a feeling of neither pleasure nor pain, he senses it disjoined from it. This is called a well-instructed disciple disjoined from birth, aging, and death, from sorrows, lamentations, pains, distresses, and despairs. He is disjoined, I tell you, from suffering and stress. This is the difference. This is the distinction. This is the distinguishing factor between the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones and the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person. And it does have actually a short a bit at the end in poem form, which I kind of liked. So I'll read the last part of it. For a learned person who has fathomed the Dhamma, clearly seeing this world and the next, desirable things don't charm the mind. Undesirable ones bring no resistance. His acceptance and rejection are scattered, gone to their end, do not exist. Knowing the dustless, sorrowless state, he discerns rightly, has gone beyond becoming to the further shore. So the Buddha had physical pain. But according to many teachers anyway, he had no dukkha around the pain. And we know he had bad knees and bad back. He had other people give talks in his stead. He would say, you know, Sariputta, I'm feeling pretty crappy today. I need to lie down. Could you please give a talk? So Sariputta would give a nice talk. And the Buddha would say, I'm the Buddha and I approve of this message. Really, pretty much that's a paraphrase of what went on. So we know that he had a lot of problems physically. We also know that things happened that that saddened him, or at least the equivalent of sadness in an enlightened being. Two of his principal followers, Moggallana and Sariputta, died near the end of the Buddha's teaching career. And the Buddha said of that, that it was like losing the sun and the moon. So he got the first arrow, but he didn't get the second arrow. So there are three kinds of dukkha. And this is an interesting teaching. And I started reading that sutta, so I'm going to skip over the beginning. There are three forms of stressfulness, my friend. The stressfulness of pain, the stressfulness of fabrication, the stressfulness of change. These are the three forms of stressfulness. So the wanderer, Jambukadika, says, but is there a path? Is there a practice for the full comprehension of these forms of stressfulness? And the Buddha says, yes, there is a path. There is a path, practice for the full comprehension of these forms of stressfulness. And then he goes on, the wanderer says, well, what is it? And the Buddha lists the Eightfold Path. So this is a very short sutta. And the only other sutta that I found that talks about these three kinds of suffering is even shorter than that. So what are they? What are the translations? And what do people think about them? And I was really puzzled by this. So I spent some time doing some research, and Barbara did some more for me. And I found that there's quite a bit of disagreement and even confusion among teachers, which made me feel a lot better. I didn't feel like I was just dense. So I'll go through the three forms, just because if I'm talking about dukkha, this is sort of, you can't leave this out, especially because Philip's book also goes through this in greater detail. So first there's dukkha-dukkha, kind of appropriate, which is just... it's usually taught as it's just our aversion to pain, our immediate reaction to physical or emotional pain. And there's a Tibetan source. I could not find anything in the Pali Canon about this, but I kind of like it, so I'll pass it along. That the Buddha describes dukkha-dukkha as being unpleasant before and during, but then pleasant afterwards. So it's sort of like we don't like it looking forward to that root canal. We don't like it while we're getting the root canal, and we're so glad when it's over. We feel really good. So that's dukkha-dukkha. Then the second one is, the name is viparinama dukkha, but it's pain from impermanence. So it's related to anicca, and anicca is the three fundamental characteristics that we all experience are or our sort of fundamental truths underlying our perception of the world are dukkha, anicca, impermanence, and anatta, the impersonality of it all, to keep it simple. So viparinama dukkha is related to anicca. It's about impermanence. Things that we like don't last. We've got to go home from work after being on that beach. We have to go home to work after being on that beach. So the Buddha says that this kind of dukkha feels pleasant before and during, but it's unpleasant afterwards because we really wish it would come back. We want to do it again. We want more of it. And then the third one is kind of tricky. It's called sankhara dukkha. And the word sankhara is another one of those words that's really hard to translate, like dukkha. A lot of Pali words are pretty straightforward. This one isn't. It's often translated as compounded or assembled, formational, or formulated. Tanisaro Bhikkhu likes to use formations. So I think of it as being related to anatta, which is, there's no real self, there's no soul, there's nothing that you can point to in the world of phenomena and say, that is myself. And it's related in the sense that nothing has thingness. When you look at any particular thing, the Buddha saw all things as being sort of functional in nature, as being like an ongoing process rather than being some discrete object in a universe. So, and you can look at how things are changing. And you can see that there is nothing reliable in anything. So this is a subtle kind of dukkha based on the deep instability of all things. That's the way it's usually described. It's a little bit like a friction. It's a subtle dukkha everywhere, but not one that you're normally aware of. So this is kind of a gloomy way of looking at things. The Buddha says it feels neutral before, during, and after. So why does that matter? Because most of the time we don't notice it, but it does subtly condition our viewpoint. It's very hard to be, you know, happy and cheerful all the time when you have this subtle, unnoticed, it's like looking through tinted glasses that are tinting everything slightly gloomy. One thing is that sometimes in deep meditation states you notice this, and I know of a practitioner who says that even in jhana, there is dukkha. It's subtle. And jhana is are those states that are supposed to be so ecstatic and sublime and joyful that, you know, people really get into trying to get jhana states and wanting more of them and so on. But even in dukkha, even in jhana, there is dukkha. So we try to avoid dukkha by numbing ourselves to it, either by, you know, running away from it, ignoring it, trying to drown it in some kind of thing that we see as being pleasant. But one way or another, we tend to numb ourselves to the unpleasantness around us, the unsatisfactory nature of things. But what happens when we numb ourselves to dukkha is that we also become insensitive to pleasure. We deaden our senses. Going back to the piña colada on the beach, you know, I felt so good on the beach that I ordered a second piña colada, because if I felt that good after one piña colada, I know I'd feel twice as good with a second piña colada. We've all been there, right? So instead of just enjoying the piña colada on the beach, we try to amp it up. It's never enough. You know, we don't just enjoy things when they're happening. We try to amp it up. We try to double the dose. We try to figure out how to get more of it. And already, we're no longer enjoying it. We're just wrapped up in this whole grasping, greedy, wanting more. So instead of enjoyment, we've just got caught up in this big story. So we tend to find a way to cloud our enjoyment. Now, those of you who have been in therapy or are therapists know that the opposite of sorrow is not said to be happiness, and the opposite of sorrow is numbness or deadness. The opposite of happiness is numbness and deadness. And our flight from dukkha leads us into that numbness. So a huge part of the path is to grow into fully emotionally alive people. So Ajahn Chah wrote, "There are two kinds of suffering, the suffering that leads to more suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. If you are not willing to face the second kind of suffering, you will surely continue to experience the first." I'm going to repeat that. There are two kinds of suffering, the suffering that leads to more suffering, the first kind, and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. And if you're not willing to face the suffering that leads to the end of suffering, then you will surely continue to experience the suffering that leads to more suffering. So the point there is that dukkha is not going to go away, but you can change your relationship to it by facing it fully, by steering into it instead of trying to avoid it. It's not going to go away. The second arrow is a habit. It's a deeply ingrained habit. But you can find a little bit more space around it, and you can, with time, lessen the effects of the second arrow. I've noticed that when I am noticing dukkha, it has a tendency to become just dukkha. Like, oh, it's just dukkha. We can see it arise and pass. It doesn't have this whole big story around it. We can become more aware of how sankhara dukkha conditions us. You know, we notice it, but it doesn't have to dominate us. It's just a characteristic. It's just something going on. Like, same as we're breathing and hearing and stuff. It doesn't have to to submerge us. So, in a sense, going back to Easter, it's really hard to appreciate the joy of Easter unless you know the sorrow of Good Friday. And in the same sense, you can't really know the wow of joy unless you're willing to fully know the ouch of pain. So we ended up with a lot of extra time for questions, maybe answers.
This is just a comment. I just was listening to a talk, and I think that the gist of the talk was that self-compassion trumps, mindful self-compassion trumps that thing called rain. So sometimes it gets too overwhelming and you need to just do mindful self-compassion. I just wanted to mention that.
And I wish I had thought to include that, because that's really important. Having compassion for oneself is not always easy to do, but it's, you know, when dukkha is strong, especially, or even the first arrow can be strong. I mean, we didn't get in at all into things like chronic pain or intense pain.
Yeah, it can be overwhelming.
Or great grief.
Something that's more compassionate for yourself.
Yeah. So compassion is a great antidote. There's also... And I didn't go into this much. I think that metta practice is a really good way to balance out the sankhara dukkha, because you can really increase your sense of friendliness towards the world. Others? Liz?
Would you say that feeling sorrow is a normal state? Because I think when... I'm not sure, but I think in general, when we feel a state of sorrow or emotional pain or dissatisfaction, we think, oh God, this is not normal, I shouldn't be feeling this. And I think that these are absolutely normal feelings that everyone has. And therefore, if we accept that and work with them, but accept that it's normal and this is not bad, this is not what we should be feeling. Other people don't feel this. They've worked with it. They don't feel it. This is, I don't know much about neurobiology, but I would imagine that they would say that this is, these are neurobiological feelings having to do with the brain and reactions. So therefore, it's what all beings need to work with.
Now, that's a great comment. Liz was saying that sorrow is something that sometimes we feel guilty about because we feel we shouldn't be feeling it, or that, you know, people who are better practitioners don't feel it, but in fact it's a very natural emotion. It's a natural response, and I like that a lot. That's why I said that sorrow is a higher state than numbness, because sorrow is a real emotion and it's a genuine, appropriate response to things that happen in the world. There are things we're really going to experience, say, grief. And grief is something that is a first arrow. And working with grief is very difficult, requires compassion for oneself, but it is natural, and one wants to accept it without judging oneself for it. And watching out for the second arrow piling on, like, why me? But, you know, there's all kinds of forms where we add to the suffering. Grief is tough enough already. You don't need to add to it. And it is natural. And you need to have compassion for oneself.
I think compassion is the answer, because if you just read the newspaper, these crashes, planes, these sinking of boats, you know, it's like, it's very tough to be with that.
Yeah.
And one would feel naturally sorrowful.
Right. That's one of the things about modern life, is that we get to see so much cause for grief around the world, where, you know, once upon a time it would be pretty much our own community and maybe news from up the river. And we get exposed to a lot, and it's very hard to deal with, and so we have a tendency to go numb. You know, we can't deal with it at all, but it's there.
Related to what you started your talk with, I think in part, this is partly what Easter is about and why we have bunnies as well as crucifixes, because I was watching a movie last night that had to do with the crucifixion. It was on the History Channel. And anyway, I was really feeling that intense sorrow for just the fact that human beings do things like this to each other and crucify people. And then ironically, the movie that was on after that was about the story of black people and how in the 1940s people would put crosses, and the Ku Klux Klan on their front lawns. And it was almost, martyrdom and crucifixion theme came up again. And when you then think about Easter with bunnies and chocolate little bunnies and all eggs and dying eggs and all that stuff, it's like that part of us that needs to numb out this event that we're remembering, and yet we can't fully even participate in remembering because it seems so horrific that people do this to others and to great beings and all of that, and how we deal with it by just thinking of something, shifting to something else.
Right, and this can be a way of coping with certain difficult situations. What our minister was saying was something about, you could use that as a way of coping with all the difficulties, but I'm all in favor of Easter bunnies and chocolate eggs. These are good things. But the celebration is even more open and expansive and beautiful if one has also gone through that sorrow and embraced it fully and able to let go of it and move beyond it.
Is the Easter bunny a symbol of something?
The Easter bunny is just one of... Easter it was a fertility cult, a fertility rite. And so rabbits are long time. They multiply a lot. They don't have a lot else going for them. They're slow, soft, and tasty. So they multiply a lot. So, fertility symbol. The eggs as well. Barbara?
I was thinking of the second arrow as kind of the attachment to these emotions. Like, if you become attached to grief in a way, I worked with a woman once who her whole life was built around a grief that had happened to her 10 years ago. And she insisted, my life is ruined. And she would not get beyond it. And it's that holy. And again, the add-ons are the forms of attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And any kind of emotion is, of course, normal. But when we become attached and we try to, we don't release, that's when we get in trouble.
Right. As Barbara says, we can get attached to an emotion, even a negative one, and identify ourselves with it. She talks about a woman who is still grieving for something that happened 10 years earlier and stoutly declares that her life is ruined. And there's a real tendency to identify with, again, going back to that simile of taking birth. She is now the person whose life is ruined, who is stuck in grief that will never go away. And, grief will keep on coming up. We know some people who have, lost children, for instance, and it's still 10 years later, often a terrible, terrible tsunami of grief, but they have a life. Mary?
In relation to, like, your theme about dukkha, that you need some dukkha, and in a sense, and one thing that I've really... gotten lately is that when I recognize, there's a phrase I just love, and it's called getting wrapped around the axle. Which I really like that.
Is that an Isadora Duncan reference?
it's about getting all pissed off.
Yeah.
And now when I find myself all of a sudden wrapped around the axle about something, and then if something happens where I recognize it, then it becomes this opportunity to practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh my God, this is just dukkha. This isn't whatever, it isn't just because this person is being a jerk. It's an opportunity to practice. And it actually is wonderful. mm-hmm. if I'm conscious enough to catch it,
yeah.
and not just buy into it.
Yeah, that's a great practice, and you, yeah. that's very mindful of you to have discovered that too. That when you face, yeah, when you face dukkha, it loses a lot of its power. When you're totally wrapped up in a story, wrapped around the axle, it's really hard. You can't think straight. And when you actually look at it, you say, oh, wow, I'm really getting torqued up here. You know, the actual situation isn't that bad. I'm just, you know, I'm wrapped around the axle. I'm in the middle of dukkha. And when you look at it, it's sort of like, sometimes it's just laughable. Look what I've done. Look what I've, you know, conjured up here.
It dissipates. Right. It's kind of joyful sense.
Right. When it does. You know, there are some kinds of suffering that are much harder to yeah. cope with, but yeah. it's amazing how many times we get torqued up over things that are pretty lightweight.
Minor. Yeah. We always talk about the suffering, but the healing part, people grieve in their own ways, and some people, it just takes a long, long time to heal. This is many, many years ago, I had a brother die, and my mother, she totally stopped talking. I mean, it was like she died inside in a way. For like 2 years, she hardly talked. I mean, she functioned, she'd make dad's dinner, she'd do, but she was really not there. She wasn't psychologically messed up or anything, it's just that she was just grieving in her own way. It was really disturbing for everyone in the family, but, you know, I mean, we tried to talk to her, and she'd mm-hmm. just say, well, I just need time, and that was it. And that was it for the conversation. And it wasn't until, like, 2 years later, when I was pregnant with my first baby, that my mother just one day just shifted, and it she was fine, but it was like for me it was like I realized that you can't make someone get better, you can't make them
yeah.
be, you can't make them not suffer, and you just have to let them grieve or heal in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
Thank you for sharing that. That's very personal. Brenda's brother died some years ago, and her mother spent 2 years in near silence, grieving, and then moved out of it. I think everybody grieves differently, and you know, something went well because you know she did return from it. And everybody evidences it in a different way. And all we can do sometimes for somebody who's in grief is to be compassionate. And, you know, we try to do what might be helpful, and we don't know what that might be.
That reminds me of there was a Buddhist, there was a nun here who 3 or 4 years ago, and she was talking about grief, and she was talking about my personal experience with grief. But the way she described grief, it was like being in a lake or some body of water, and you could only swim out as fast as you can swim out. And those around you are saying, hurry, hurry, but you can only move as fast as you can move.
Mm-hmm.
The sorrow and the just dog paddle, or maybe just red water.
Right.
Her description of when it finally comes to an end, I still remember it. So it's like your heart, for her it was like her heart was a really tight rosebud that just all of a sudden broke open, like those old Matthew Disney films, and, you know, time back.
Right, the time lapse.
This beautiful rose. Came to be, or peony,
yeah.
From where this tightly wound blood was for as long as it was there. And no matter what anybody else tried to say, you need to move through it, whatever, it happened when it happened.
Yeah, and I think it's, you want to keep moving, but the grief will take its own time. And again, people, if you're grieving and you're fighting against the grief, it'll tend to stay longer. There are times when there's grief, grieve.
So I'm a little confused because in your talk, it would seem like the grief is the second arrow.
Well, I think they're real. If somebody dies, you're going to feel grief.
Yeah.
Even the Buddha, when his two closest associates died, mm-hmm. you know, felt something akin to grief. So I think there is something that it is first arrow about grief. But there's, you can, and this is like the imprecision of language. There are parts of it where you can really extend it, like the woman that Barbara worked with, who 10 years later was so identified with her grief that she could never even consider the possibility of being without it or moving on to it. So clearly there's something beyond just a natural response to losing a loved one. If you lose a loved one, you're going to feel sorrow and grief. So I don't think of that as being second arrow. But there isn't a good, clear linguistic step between a normal grief and the stuff that we add on.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
But I'm glad you brought that.
In those terms, the second, looking at it.
Right, it's sort of, and it's...
Would be inhuman as far as I'm concerned.
And it's hard to tell where we're getting into second arrow territory in some of these. Yeah. Barbara?
Well, I think part of releasing grief is really being with it. And to really be with it, you may have to be with it for a while. You know, sort of like, there's sometimes temptation, all I have to do is feel this. Sometimes, okay, all I have to do is get into this feeling and it'll go away. But it takes time to really face that feeling and really be with it. And your mother sounded like she really knew what she was doing that way, saying, give me time. She saw, she wasn't, she just had to be with it. I think it's in the rabbinic tradition where when you have a sorrow, you take the dust and ashes of the sorrow, of the pain, and pour it over your head. Actually, immerse yourself in just to really be with it.
Right. I think sometimes people who are grieving pretend after a while that they're not grieving, or with the feeling that they should be over it by now, so I'll just go on. And I think this ends up being a form of the second arrow. Because you have not only the pain, but you have the struggle to deal with the pain and pretend it's not there and so on.
Philip always says, this is what grief feels like. This is what anger feels like. So it makes it really real.
Yeah.
This is what I'm feeling. This is what I'm going through. This is what grief feels like. This is what anger feels like.
Yeah, and I found that it's like this is something that Ajahn Sumedho uses.
Yes.
It's like this, but being very specific, it's like this. This is what grief is like. This is what anger is like. That can be a wonderful technique. I've done that, and sometimes what it'll do is it'll give you just a little bit of space from whatever that afflictive emotional situation is. And it may not go away, but all of a sudden it's just a characteristic of experience rather than you, rather than identifying yourself as the angry person. You just become a person who has some anger. So you have a little bit of space around that afflictive emotion.
I like the characteristic of experience. It's a lovely phrase. I like that. Yeah.
In the back?
Yeah, I'm thinking that there's a third arrow.
And probably a fourth, fifth, and sixth, too.
Judging
the second arrow? Yes. Oh, right. Well, like I've piled all this stuff on myself. I'm such a crappy person for having done that. So, yeah, you could think of that as a third arrow. And you say, oh, wow, I'm being really judgmental. That's a fourth arrow in a way. So,
we tend to want to discount by calling it a story.
discount?
Discount by calling what we're hearing or from ourselves story.
Uh-huh.
And that's a way of judging the other person's feeling. And I think that, in fact, for me, putting dukkha into words to myself or other people is a way of living with it fully, being it, embracing it, looking at it, all of those things. And you could call that, oh, you're just into your story. And we have to be very careful about discounting what dukkha is.
Yes. Yes, I agree with that. I would add that there's a danger in dealing. You can know your own dukkha, but it's hard to know other people's dukkha. So, you know, one must always be very careful about judgments with what's going on with other people. Anyone else?
Some warmth around it and some friendliness to it, and kind of think of it as a teacher instead of the enemy.
Yeah,
what Diane said, she was whispering, I was sitting next to her and said, I don't want to fight it.
Right. No, I know the tendency is to fight it. And I like that. And it goes along, you have some warmth and friendliness towards it. I saw a nun speak recently. Actually, it was just a conversation, I think, with Sister Ananda Bodhi, who has had trouble with depression in the past. And she says that now, and it still comes back sometimes, but she says now when it comes up again, it's sort of like almost like a visit from an old friend. She says, oh, yeah, I know this. So I think, again, I think a related practice is metta for oneself, and metta in the sense not of trying to fight, oh, I'm going to slather some metta on to suppress the bad feelings, that tends to add to the struggle. So that's really kind of a subtle form of second arrow. But if you can just have metta for your situation and even for the suffering or for the grief, you know, just open the experience to that. I love one teacher I heard recently, and I think it might be Donald Rothberg, liked the translation of metta. You know, we usually translate it loving kindness, which is another Victorian era translation. He likes to use the word radiant friendliness, and I really like that. Wait. Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say that sometimes when you're in the middle of the dukkha, for instance, the concept of grief, and people think of it as an experience where it lasts for a year at a time, and that the whole time you're in this state, it's continuous, but that's the mind that isn't really paying attention to just this moment, this moment. Because even when you're grieving someone or something, really it's a series of different things. And there'll be parts of the day when you'll be in a state of grief, and
right,
there'll be other moments of time where you're free, or you're involved in something else and you're engaged, and you're really not.
Right.
And part of it is just our forgetting that we're not paying attention to the moments.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, it's not a state that lasts for continuously. It's a series of moments, and moment by moment. And I think that's sort of the unraveling of dukkha, and maybe those difficult emotions like grief, is going back to just this moment.
Yeah. He's always pointing out that grief, we think of grief as being, it goes on for a period of time and then it stops. And it really doesn't work that way. That there are times when it's not there and times when it comes back very strongly. And part of the process is just being mindful of what's going on. Our friends who lost their son, you know, would go for a long periods of time and then just suddenly be struck with just tremendous, almost insupportable grief. And it comes and goes, and it still does 10 years later. It never entirely goes away, the sorrow of losing one that you're close to, that you've been close to. Katie?
I was just thinking, maybe I read too many obituary pages. You know, people, I was thinking of disease as dukkha for obvious reasons. My partner has a disease that's, you know, get over, you die from it, whatever. But they always say in the paper, they fought, you know.
Yeah, right, right.
And we admire the people that courageously fought.
Right.
I was thinking of that in terms of this whole talk.
My obituary is going to say he cravenly surrendered to his disease with nary a fight at all. That'll get their attention, won't it?
I just think it's another way of thinking about things.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the thing about having a disease that you can fight and you want to fight it. It's, of course, good, you know, wise practice to go ahead and do so. But you, it's sort of like to fight it, you need to know it as it is, not how you'd like it to be or how you imagine it. It's sort of like what Philip uses the phrase, start where you are. Mm-hmm. You really need to know your situation, and that's the ground that you fight the disease from. So you fight it not by running away from it, you fight it by facing it.
Yeah, I really appreciate Zoe's comment about how, you know, grief comes and goes. And I think part of the problem can sometimes be is, I'm not feeling grief right now, there's something the matter. You judge yourself, you're not feeling pain.
Yeah.
And it would the same thing with fighting a disease. I mean, you know, that rather than just being open.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because sometimes I have felt after a relative died that I wasn't grieving enough. So I was trying, gee, I really ought to think of things I really liked about Uncle Sandy and whip up more grief. What am I, you know, callous and unfeeling? So, yeah, it's, you don't want to force grief just because you feel you should either. Well, we're running out of time, so, oh, sorry, we have gone after. So if we can just find a comfortable position again. And do we have meta cards?
May Helen and Grace be at peace and in comfort in their new lives. Or my friend Bob, who just found out he has aggressive prostate cancer.
Holding these and others in our hearts. We try to radiate a warmth and friendliness out towards them and to everyone in the room and beyond. We'll repeat the formal phrases of the loving kindness practice. You'll repeat them after me. And when you're saying the phrases, you are radiating good wishes to everyone and beyond. And in the silence thereafter, see if you can receive the good wishes. May you be safe from internal and external harm.
May you be safe from internal and external harm.
May you have a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart.
May you have a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart.
May you be physically strong, healthy, and vital.
May you be physically strong, healthy, and vital.
May you experience love, joy, wonder, and wisdom in this life just as it is.
May you experience love, joy, wonder, and wisdom in this life just as it is.
May our practice tonight be to the benefit of all those around us and everyone that we might meet. If we have gained any merit from our practice tonight, we dedicate it unreservedly to all beings, those near and those far, those large and those small, those we fear and those we love. May all beings everywhere find the path to the end of suffering.